reports engineers have also been upgrading its computers.
For the past few days, engineers have been updating the software on Curiosity. When it reached Mars, the main software on board was primarily designed to run the systems needed to assure a safe landing. The new software is designed to make running things like the robotic arm and scientific instruments more efficient. Engineers have been running those instruments through their paces to make sure they didn't get harmed during landing. The rover also prepared to send more images to Earth that were taken as Curiosity descended to the surface of Mars. Engineers say they may be ready to take a test drive in a week or so. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. stocks easing up with the Dow gaining 4, NASDAQ up 14, S&P 500 up 2. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the next 20 years, the number of Americans 65 and over is expected to triple. And as the number of older Americans grows, so will the need for long-term care and the costs associated with providing that care. In this hour of the show, though, we'll hear about an approach that helps seniors stay in their homes, providing great benefits to them and also saving a lot of money because it can work for just a fraction of the cost of nursing home care. Our guest for the program is Dr. Alan Teal, and we'll talk about his book, Alone and Invisible No More. The subtitle is How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. Chelsea Green is the publisher on the book. A little bit about our guest. Dr. Teal is a family physician who lives in Damariscotta, Maine. During his medical career of 25 years, he's worked with a lot of people, particularly older patients in hospitals and nursing homes, people in assisted living situations, and also in their own homes. And he says that his experience with working with older folks has led him really to be an advocate and to talk a lot about the crisis that faces our nation, our community. And Dr. Teal, hello.
Hello, David. Nice to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk with you as well. I think this is a great story, and I think that people will appreciate hearing about it and thinking about it, learning about what you have done and you know, thinking about the possibility of taking some of your experiences and seeing if that can work in their community, because I think you really make the argument that that this is a kind of model can be, people can take it and bring it to their own communities and make it work as well for them as it has for you in Maine.
That's right. And as you mentioned in your introduction, this comes out of having worked in all sorts of parts of the healthcare system and facing the demographics and economics that currently trouble everybody dealing with successful aging or empowered aging. It is important that there be more choice. And over the 25 years that I've worked with older individuals, I've been impressed with their wisdom and experience, and it really surprised me that there were not more ways to champion their cause, to that there were not more people that were really focused on how are we going to address quality of life and cost in a very different way than what we're doing right now.
And you certainly, we can't get away from talking about cost, and that is definitely is an issue here. But also, I'm sure you would want to stress that quality of life is a big issue as well, and that you know, we know that folks want to be as much as they can and for as long as they can. People want to stay in their homes. In fact, there are probably people who stay in their homes when they shouldn't, in situations that are where their quality of life is maybe not not very good, but they're there because they don't want to leave their homes.
Right. I'm really trying to get the medical profession and the healthcare world to reestablish a better balance between the medical and the non-medical aspects of somebody's life. We've really medicalized aging so that it's all about pills and continence and fall risk and all of these other kinds of things, where most older individuals, I think, would agree that the reason to get up in the morning are connections to family, to friends, to pets, to community interests, to personal interests. Those are the things that give purpose and meaning. And without those connections, the rest of it really doesn't matter. So what we're trying to embrace is a really true quality of life that is focused on a very different attitude. And that attitude is really trying to challenge the healthcare world, challenge families, challenge the elders themselves, to really start to think about what it is you want to do with the rest of your life. When was the last time we asked 85 or 90-year-olds what was on their bucket list? You know, what do you want to do? You don't look like you're dying tomorrow, so if you're going to be here for several more years, what's important to you and how can we help you accomplish those things? And from a very caregiving part of the equation, we're trying to break down loneliness and isolation, and many older individuals have expressed to me their frustration at not being useful. So what we've captured is those things that older individuals can do something useful for somebody else, and how do you mold their energy, their experience into a different at-home paradigm than what we have right now.
Yeah, and we'll talk some more about this, but about the fact that the kind of approach that you're talking about relies quite heavily on volunteers and on people who are willing to be buddies for people who are living in their homes. And the thing there that I think is so appealing about it is that the bonus here is that so not only do you have someone who may be a frail elderly person, you can maintain them in their home, and that's good for them and for their quality of life. See, it seems that your publisher has done a really nice little documentary that people can watch on the web. And what I was really impressed by when I looked at that was the people who are the volunteers. The bonus is what they get out of having this bond with the person that they're helping out.
Right. We've moved to the point that everybody needs to and can volunteer. And there is science behind that as well as feel-good parts of that. There is very good data now that says that those that volunteer for others, even 2 hours a week, end up having less heart disease, better chronic disease management, less depression, they live longer. So it is really important as a part of healthcare to make it part of your prescription for successful aging that you do something for others. And actually it's been shown that the older you are, the more benefits you get out of this. For, not surprisingly, this thing that we talked about, that many older individuals feel isolated. And so as we face a situation where we do not have enough caregivers to deal with this gray tsunami of aging America in the next 20 years, and we don't have enough dollars to do it the way we're doing it now, it's imperative that we engage the elder cohort themselves as a significant part of the solution. Mm-hmm. The other very interesting part of that is that in the medical field, when you try to ask older individuals to prospectively look at their future and take the bull by the horns and do something different, they really back off and say, no, I'm fine. And so I really think the way to get people involved is to help them help somebody else rather than shine the lens directly on them and remind them of their limitations. I think that is usually counterproductive.
Yeah, and just to again, one more time here to follow up on the point about the how we meet the need when we have a growing number of folks who are in the older age groups, that even if we, I just want to sort of underscore this point, that to put people into nursing homes or even in some kind of assisted living situation, even if we thought that was a good idea, it seems like that's just not on, given the need and the expense. We couldn't afford to build and staff all those nursing homes, even if we decided that was the way to go.
No, I've done some simple math, and I would encourage others to replicate it. But those that have shopped for residential care for a loved one know that assisted living homes are in the neighborhood of $5,000 or $6,000 per person per month. Nursing homes are in the $9,000 or $10,000 per person per month, and certainly they are in the Northeast. And so we're spending about $1 million per bed per decade for every single one of those residential care beds. And as we are going to grow from the 35 million over 65 that we have right now to 85 million, and within that cohort, we will have close to 20 million people that are over 85 years old and over 1 million people that are over 100 years old within the next few decades. We're dealing with situations that have historically been handled by residential care. Most people over age 85, or certainly most people over 100, you know, and most people over age 90 are living in a residential care facility at these types of costs that we're talking about. So we do not have enough dollars. If we think they're struggling in Washington, you know, and in state capitals right now dealing with their Medicare and Medicaid programs, well, they haven't seen anything yet if they try to address the aging of America with the same solutions that we've used up until this point.
Yeah. To introduce our guest again for this hour, maybe you just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Alan Teal. He's a family physician in Damariscotta, of Maine. He's the author of the book Alone and Invisible No More, How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. And it's published by Chelsea Green. Also, if you're interested in, we'll talk some more about this in what they call the Maine approach, and that's Maine as in state of Maine. One thing that people might do if you have web access, you put into your browser Full Circle America, or you can go to fullcircleamerica.com, and you can get the basics and find out what the Maine approach is about and learn about the kinds of system here that they have pioneered there in Maine. And questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just if we can, I'm sure we'll talk in some depth about the various parts of the approach, but just on, if I just say, you know, give me the 1 minute answer on, well, what is the Maine approach? How do you introduce people to the
sure.
idea?
Well, it's a combination of using people, attitude, and technology. Hmm. And the people part of it is that all of our communities have a number of resources, whether they be community centers, schools, theaters, senior programs. We have rec centers. And many of the older individuals in our communities are isolated from the community at large. We don't have an awful lot of intergenerational things happening. We do not have a lot of utilization of these community facilities by older individuals. They're relatively invisible. So part of it is using existing community resources more cleverly so that you don't have to incur new expense. A lot of it is attitude, where, as I alluded to before, you start thinking of older individuals as an integral part of your community. And by that I mean most folks who have had a visit with an older individual come away from that experience enriched and enlivened from what transpired. And so it is really trying to make those things happen more readily. And the technology is trying to use things like webcams, motion sensors, video calling, Skype applications, conference calls, personal emergency buttons, as well as all of a variety of remote monitoring devices so that we can keep people in their own homes with very close, as close supervision as they want, at a fraction of the cost of what traditionally would be in-home 24/7 personal care.
Mm-hmm. This is, and I'm sure that probably some, right away some people will have questions about that. They'll have questions particularly about issues of privacy. But it's it is something that seems that it can work really well with putting webcams in the public areas of homes. So you can kind of, you know, see, kind of keep an eye on people and have them maintain their privacy.
Right. I don't think people would have noticed if they hadn't really seen it happen themselves.
Uh-huh.
The technology could be warm and fuzzy. You know, I think anyone that's had a Skype video call with a family member who lives at a distance is immediately drawn into what a better experience that is than just a telephone call. I think folks that have had a webcam in their living room, that they pretty much forget that it is there. When an adult son or daughter from another part of the country looks at mom or dad doing very well in their own space, it brings a great deal of comfort and reassurance to them that it is okay for mom and dad to stay in their own homes. And from the other side of the equation, we've had 85 and 90-year-olds who agreed to sign up to have some of our services because they wanted to get their kids off their back. Their kids were pushing them to move somewhere else where they didn't want to move to, and this was a good compromise for them.
And this, I really am intrigued by the idea that we tend to think about it's younger people who are on the cutting edge of information communication technologies, but there's no reason why, perhaps by making, you might have to make them just a little bit more user-friendly, but there's no reason why everybody couldn't use them, and that's one way of getting around this issue that we face so much today where parents and children are geographically, they're so far apart.
That's right. We've ended up to focus on a few very user-friendly devices. To give you an example, we use something called a standalone Skype video phone made by a company called Asus, A-S-U-S. And this particular device has a touchscreen on it, and so all you have, and it doesn't do anything else except make video calls.
Mm.
And the touchscreen is about a 10-inch screen, so it's a pretty good-sized picture. And on that picture, rather than trying to get my dad to open the lid on the laptop or point the mouse at some application, all he has to do is find the picture of the golfing buddy or the son or daughter that he wants to talk to and press that picture, and it generates a live video call to that person. So he doesn't have to do anything else except just scroll through the pictures and make a call to the person he wants to talk to.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who was listening to us this morning here in Urbana, where we are, and they're on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is an excellent topic. I don't know if you're aware, but in Illinois we have another class of assisted living. It's called supportive living, and that actually takes the cost down even further to a resident, lower than assisted living. And I didn't know if you're familiar with the model, and if there are other states out there that are looking to start that type of model.
Well, can you just tell us a little bit more about
supportive living? Is more independent, a little bit more independent than assisted living. And what the state of Illinois has done is allowed the facility to take in individuals who have a lower income. And when they come in, they may have assets, but if they spend their assets down to below $2,000, then that person can still stay at the facility by switching over and using services like Medicaid, Medicare, I can't remember which is which, but then they can sign up for SNAP benefits and there are other benefits that they may have through the state and federal government, allowing them to stay in their, what would be their new home, their apartment, without having to be moved out, like, say, an assisted living facility.
Hmm.
So they have moved into a new supportive living unit, or are they staying in their own homes?
No, they're not staying in their own homes. It is a supportive living unit. The one in Urbana has, I believe, 90-some apartments. I have a parent there. It's a wonderful place. And they can stay there until their care needs become such that they can't take care of them anymore. Mm-hmm. They have meals, they have housekeeping, they have laundry services and activities and, mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. But it's extremely independent, and it's keeping my parent out of a nursing home where they don't need to be, but they can't be at home because they just need a little bit of assistance. So it's kind of in between, and it's only, I don't want to say only, but it is $3,000 a month, but they have enough means to pay that. But if they were an assisted, even in Champaign County, the assisted living is close to $6,000.
Sure. Well, I think you bring up a couple of very good points, and that is it should be about choice. There should be many more options for people, and if this is a kind of choice that is attractive to the individual and their family, then by all means, it is something to pursue. And, I think the issues that I'm trying to push are the fact that we need to have more choice. And what I've been pleasantly surprised at is that folks that we would have traditionally thought to be too frail to stay in their own homes, with a little bit of remote supervision and some targeted on-site care, we've been able to keep folks with mild to moderate memory impairment, people that are dealing with walkers, sometimes even wheelchairs. We've been able to keep them in their own home, their own environment, safely for up to 4 years. So I think we've shown that folks that the healthcare field, myself included, wouldn't have thought that they could live independently in their own home any longer, that we've shown that they can. And so what I'm trying to promote is that there is choice. There are many people like your parent that have moved into a residential care facility and really are very happy there. And if they have the means to do it and it makes them happy, I think that is ideal. That's what it's all about. It's all about quality of life. And if it works for them, I'm thrilled for your family. What it is about to me, though, is expanding the choices, giving people more options, and trying to work within the myriad of interests and budgets that different people have.
Do you know, do insurance companies or does Medicaid, Medicare, are some of these technologies that are out there, are they reimbursable?
Well, the government is starting to do that. The Medicaid program is doing it. A lot of times it's couched under telemedicine, so we still have the same challenges of a system trying to medicalize it in a big way. And I'm not sure that a health care plan like Medicare or Medicaid is quite focused enough on that how many positive health benefits there are for improving someone's social network. And so will they pay for they'll pay for technologies to bring your blood pressures and your pulse rate and your weight to the doctor's offices, but will they spring for Skype video calls and other types of social interaction because they are in people's best interests? So far, that has been way more progressive than where those fields are going or have gone so far. As far as will other insurers pay for it, we've had a few long-term care insurance policy holders whose policies have paid for our services because they have a lot of latitude. But it is policy by policy and not even company by company. So there are options for some of those that have long-term care insurance. But what we've been trying to do is create a very robust model of technology, volunteers, the elders themselves, and we've been able to do it for about $350 per person per month. So that brings it into a whole different arena than where other players are. Now, again, if you need a lots of one-on-one care, these cameras won't make the bed or help you with your bath, so you have to add on some personal care. But if you add on even an hour or two a day of personal care to 22 hours a day of all of this other technology, you're still in the neighborhood of $1,000 or $1,500 a month rather than $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month. So there are a lot of options for people, and it really depends on building a program around that individual's needs and desires, and trying to target the labor that is needed so that it can fit within not only the budget but the social constraints of that particular individual. There are many older individuals that don't want a lot of strangers in their space. And even though they might need that care, they are quite reluctant to acknowledge that. So we're, in response to David Inge's question a little bit ago about privacy, for a lot of individuals, the remote technology that we're offering is seen as being less intrusive than having to entertain a caregiver in the home.
Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your time.
Well, thanks
well, thank
for, the
you for calling.
And I'm sure that you would make the pitch if you needed to make the pitch that certainly there would be more, you'd be able to maintain more of your privacy staying in your home than you would going into a nursing home, for sure.
Yes, and I think the biggest invasion of your privacy is having to move into a residential care facility mm-hmm. and share half a bedroom, half a bath, half a closet, half a bureau with a complete stranger. Those are the things that are a way bigger invasion of your privacy. But one of the things that I would encourage us all to think about, and it's really hit me very hard over the last 10 or 15 years, is to come to terms with risk for our parents. And when we were, as a family, were caring for my grandmother in her 90s quite a while ago, it was pretty clear that she wanted to be in her own space with her own cat, having her own set routine. Was she quite frail? Sure. Were we as a family willing to accept the possibility that she might fall because it would kill her to have to move from her apartment or to be living in a place where she couldn't have her cat? Absolutely, it would have. So we came to terms with accepting a certain amount of risk on her behalf, and I've since borrowed a phrase from the developmentally disabled community that pioneered things about 20 or 30 years ago with an expression called the dignity of risk. And the dignity of risk says that in order to be able to grow as an individual, you have to have the opportunity to succeed or to fail. And if we're only willing to accept a solution that guarantees success, we are probably going to deprive that individual of a real-world situation that will allow them the opportunity to grow. And so I think it behooves us as adult children of aging parents to take a closer look at what risks we are comfortable with and what are the pros and cons of an individual staying in their own environment. And I think what I've been pleasantly surprised at is how few crises with the folks that we've cared for have really ensued. We've cared for now about 100 people who are between the ages of 80 and 105 years old for up to 4 years, and we've had very few crises. And we've not had anyone whose situation couldn't be handled in some rather creative way. Now, clearly, people that are more fragile and have lots more hands-on care needs have to have more hands-on care. But for the most part, it is surprising to me how few circumstances really develop over the course of a month or a year that really require some more traditional medical intervention. To give you the example of my poster girl, Helen, she had moved to a nursing home and was living there for 6 months, quite content with the care, but missing her home. And with her daughter's blessing, we moved her back home again. And even though she was declared by all of the reviewers as requiring nursing home level of care, she lived independently in her own home with 1 to 2 hours a day of personal care and 22 to 23 hours a day of remote monitoring. And she lived in that environment for 4 years with one tiny emergency room visit for a cut on her forehead that needed a Band-Aid. That was really the only medical attention that this nursing home requiring individual had in 4 years, despite all of the suppositions to the contrary. Mm. So I think that's just one example. There have been many others that I could tell you about, but I think we have to, as a community and as individual families, really take a closer look at risk, dignity of risk, and what are the pros and cons for the different choices that are facing our family and our parents.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Alan Teal. He's a family physician in Damariscotta, Maine. And he's talking about the approach that he and some other folks have pioneered there, taking advantage of technology and social networking and a lot of volunteers to help frail elderly folks stay in their homes, people who perhaps otherwise might end up in assisted living or ended up in a nursing home. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Patrick Ball is considered one of the premier Celtic harpers and spoken word artists in the world today. Heart-stoppingly gorgeous is how one reviewer described his music. Patrick will make a return appearance at Heartland Gallery in Urbana Wednesday night and on Live and Local Wednesday at noon, this time playing his brass-strung harp live in the studio. This is a show I think you won't want to miss. It's Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour, our guest is Dr. Alan Teal. He's a family physician. He lives in Maine. He is the author of the book Alone and Invisible No More that talks about something that they call the Maine approach, that is Maine as in state of Maine. He explains it in the book. And also, by the way, if you'd like to get a sense of what this is about, you can take a look at the website of Full Circle America. So go to fullcircleamerica.com, or I think if you just put Full Circle America in your web browser, if you have internet, it'll take you there, and you can get a sense of what the Maine approach is. And as he has explained, it's something that has been developed to take advantage of things like technology and also a lot of volunteering to help elderly people stay in their homes. And they're people, as we've explained, they're people that might, under other circumstances, end up in a nursing home or in some kind of assisted living circumstance, people who want to stay in their homes. And using this kind of structure, they've made it possible for people to indeed to stay in their homes. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, and thank you for this program, and really valuable. I wanted to make a comment, and then also had a question. The comment is, if somebody hasn't been through this as a child of an elderly person, they don't may not understand what value this is, not just to the elderly person themselves, but to the extended family. It's really heartbreaking to see your parents go to an assisted living when you know that they're just this close to being able to stay in their home, but you just can't marshal the resources and the organization among your family members and so forth to do it. And so it's really not just for them, it's for the whole family and by extension, the extended community and so forth. But my question is, you know, I'm sure there are a number of ways to get this started. in a community, but you know, what are the most common or the most likely in terms of partnering with an existing community or county or state or federal organization, or starting from scratch? Do you need a storefront or bricks and mortar and computers and desks? And, you know, what does it take to get it going?
Sure. Well, thank you for your call. What we are trying to do and what I put out in the book is a call to action that said that we need to replicate this model in 10,000 communities across the United States in the next 10 years in order to just reach 1% of the target population. So it's a big task ahead of all of us, and the only way we're going to be able to do it is if we take the commitment that folks like you and your family speak of and give people the tools and organization to do that. We've chosen to do this by making it as much of a turnkey operation as is possible. We are looking to partner with a number of other communities, and again, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. If people already have starters in their community, then we work with them. Over the last 6 months, I've been approached by folks that are in the home care business themselves, individuals that are disgruntled, social workers or nurses that would like to do something like this in their own community. I've had churches approach me. I've had people that run Meals on Wheels programs. I've had federal CAP agencies who do some weatherization programs ask whether they could replicate this. So I think the issue is that our focus through Full Circle America is to make this as much of a turnkey operation for individuals in a community who want to spearhead this. Do you need a storefront? Not necessarily. We are going to take it on ourselves to ship you the technology to keep updating what works the best. We will provide the administrative support of everything from payroll to HR to all of the other administrative stuff for a person or wanting to do, or an organization wanting to do this in their community. We'll do the 24/7 remote monitoring of the webcams and motion sensors so that people don't have to have the learning curve of doing that. And so we're looking to build a model that is replicable in other communities. And our focus for right now is that we're trying to raise the support and create the network to begin this in 25 other communities in 2012, and then hopefully 100 communities in 2013, and so on. You know, so we are taking this job very seriously. We would welcome collaboration from any individuals or organizations in other places. We are looking for people who know the need, know their community, and are not only have the heart that it takes, but also the connections to their community, because there is a lot of nervousness among individuals who and their families to stay in their own homes. And so it takes collaboration between not only a group like ourselves with some of the experience, but also some boots on the ground in the community who are willing to help create this kind of an approach.
Right. Let me just follow up and say then, for a person like myself or someone else listening today who doesn't have a tremendous amount of volunteer time but would like to volunteer but maybe not be at the center of this, should they call somebody?
Sure.
Where would they start calling and say, hey, have you heard about this? This sounds like a great idea.
I think the easiest way is to encourage people to learn a bit more about it from either our website or the book.
Okay.
And then the contact information that are in those places can lead those individuals to touch base with us, and then we can proceed down that path further. And again, what we're trying to do is make it so that it is a collaborative effort with lots of people volunteering and lots of existing community resources. And the families, as you no doubt experience, every family member has to pitch in some way, but you just need a little bit of help beyond what you can do yourselves. Everybody has their own family and job commitments as well, and so they get spread so thinly that we're just really trying to fill in the gaps for families that are already doing a lion's share of the work, and we want to piggyback on what they're already doing.
Well, thanks so much. It's a brilliant idea, and I hope it's extremely successful nationwide or even worldwide, and that all of the people listening can play some role in it at some point. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll go on. Let's talk with someone. This is also someone listening in Champaign on our line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, from about 1997 to 2000, I worked as a software developer on a electronic system, basically a computer system that would do something like this. I didn't hear your whole show today, so I may have missed something, but basically would be installed in a patient's home and allow them to take medical measurements as well as do video conferencing with a doctor or nurse. And so your show is really interesting to me. I've always been surprised by that I haven't heard more about systems like this since then. At the time, we ran into problems with the lack of broadband in the country. I noticed that there's still a lot of talk about the need to spread the availability of broadband. And back then, if you remember, 11 years ago, it was much
very
less
difficult.
Yes. So the video conferencing aspect was therefore much less marketable without broadband, because a phone line dial-up just didn't provide nearly the same kind of really just didn't support it at all, and that really kind of I think led to the downfall of the marketability of that system. But I was amazed when I hired on the kind of stuff that they could do with that. They were able to do. We ended up with blood pressure, blood glucose, weight, as well temperature, as well as I think a couple of other measurements that people could just do in their home with a nice touchscreen interface with big buttons, and the customer didn't even have to know how to do Windows or anything like that. All they had to interact with was the custom-built system, and it really seemed like a neat application. I've been kind of surprised I haven't heard about more of that since then.
Sure. Well, a couple of comments. First off, you were, ahead of your time on that. Over the last decade, even though coverage in rural areas in particular is not great, we do have an awful lot of DSL. We do have a lot of different internet service providers with a variety of bandwidths and speeds. You do have cell technology that, with 3G and 4G and LTE and all of those other things, give enormously better speed and access to sharing information. So, those things have changed, and they've changed significantly just in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
As the other part that I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you might have missed is that I'm also trying to push the discussion to more of the social interactions and the social networking for older individuals and those that are isolated. So, yes, you absolutely can transfer data from lots of devices for blood pressures, O2 sats, EKGs, all of those kinds of things quite easily now. But to try to reestablish a balance between the medical and the non-medical so that we in the medical field give more credence to how important the non-medical aspects of somebody's life is, that they can focus. It should be that not only should you have video calling with your doctor if you want, but you need to video call a grandson so you can see the new dog or cat that they have, so that you can see the new apartment they're living in, so that you can reconnect families that are spread out across the country, so that I can have video calls with my golfing buddies even though I don't drive at night anymore, or I don't drive at all, And so how do I video stream a lot of the things that are going on in the community into my home so that I can still be fully engaged with a number of things that used to be important to me and actually still are. I just can't get to them the way I used to.
That's really interesting. Okay. At the time we were working on that system, a lot of studies had been done on much simpler systems that mainly just had a five-button interface that allowed patients to enter data to say they could do measurements on normal traditional systems, and they could do stuff like enter what their weight was, indicate whether they had swelling or any other issues like that, and it would be transferred over in a traditional phone line, and as well as like maybe do some trivia questions, things like that for fun to make it a little more palatable for the user.
Sure.
And I was impressed at some of the research that had been done on that even just simple systems like that that provided a little, you know, a daily regimen with and they would of course make some of those quizzes educational to remind people what kind of diet they should be eating, because a lot of these people would be homebound for stuff like diabetes, advanced diabetes, and things like that. And those kind of systems provided really surprisingly good outcome improvements just for really a really simple device like that.
Well, you pointed out that we really are just barely scratching the surface because no one is really aggressively turning this available technology toward a whole cohort that needs it desperately, and we've used some simpler devices that have touchscreen interfaces and now have Wi-Fi enabled innards, so that people don't so that they can be very portable. And again, it is important that you break things down into one step, two step interactions rather than three, four, five, six steps. It is really important that we find ways to make the user be able to participate very, very simply. This is very new to many individuals to actually communicate this way, and we have to make it much simpler than many of the current applications.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller and to just to mention here, we only have about 5 minutes left with our guest, Dr. Alan Teal. I would like to ask a question here that came in by email. I don't know what you might say to this. Someone who was wondering whether perhaps some of the things that you have done and some of the things that you have learned can also be applied for people who, and as we have explained, the goal here is for people to stay in their homes. Can you apply some of this to people who have already moved into assisted care or into a nursing home?
Absolutely. I think there every year we probably face a quarter or a third of people having to move from assisted living to higher levels of care.
Mm-hmm.
It might be true for your caller that talked about supportive living the same way. You know, that again, if you can bring these technologies into the environment that individual now calls home, can they, quote, age in place? Can they stay there longer because this gives them additional support? Absolutely. You know, and I think it has the ability for all of these facilities to do a better job of what they're doing. You know, quality of life and improved costs are an issue for every facility as well as for every individual at home. And I think we're going to see more combinations where there are networks that take care of people, some in residential care. One of the other things that I think we've just pioneered but we're scratching the surface on is taking individuals and moving them into each other's homes, buddying them up in the spare bedroom of somebody else's house that already has some of these services in place. So can you also serve a social need, make the residential component way, way cheaper than an institution would be, and make it very personalized? One of the other areas that has startled me with their dedication to doing something similar has been how much the population of individuals with disabilities and their families have come forward, and they're saying, we want this for our adult children with disabilities as well. We want to be able to have them live in community. We don't want them to have to live in a residential care facility. We want them to have full participation in an intergenerational community where their particular talents are valued. And so I'm working quite closely now with United Cerebral Palsy and some of the other developmentally disabled groups to implement some of these same approaches with their target population. Yeah.
Now, we have just about a minute, but I would just like to, you mentioned your dad in passing. Your father is involved in this program, right?
I've teased him about being my guinea pig from day one, and he very freely has let me use his experience to show others, and so we use his cameras, his motion sensors, his experiences a lot to demonstrate to other people.
Yeah. Is this something that I don't know how big a community Damariscotta is. I'm assuming that it's a relatively small community. Is this something that works best in a small community, or can it be something that you can do in an urban area? Yeah.
Sure. I think absolutely. I think what we're trying to do is break down larger communities into bite-sized pieces of 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we're kind of focusing on neighborhoods and sections of town. And I think it will reassure individuals about the safety and networking, kind of like a neighborhood watch kind of thing,
uh-huh.
You know, that there would be ways. We haven't had an opportunity yet to test it, but as I said, in 2012, there's interest in Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Boston, Santa Fe. So there's no reason that it should not work, and we'll be able to tell you better after those communities have tried it next year.
Well, it's a terrific idea, and we're here. We have to finish, but I'll mention once again, if people would like to find out more about the Maine approach, that is Maine as in the state of Maine, you can either look at the book, which our guest Alan Teal has written, Alone and Invisible No More, published by Chelsea Green, or if you'd like to get a sense of how this approach can work, you go to the website that's Full Circle America. So you just go to Full Circle America, or go to FullCircleAmerica.com, or just put Full Circle America in your browser. You'll get there. You can find out more about it. And our guest this morning is Dr. Alan Teal. He's a family physician in Damariscotta, Maine. Dr. Teal, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, David. I look forward to talking to you again.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, whose 29th season features a 90th birthday celebration for composer George Walker, Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, hosts The Planets, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, conducted by Fred Stoltzfus, and Rush Hour in April. Ticket information is available at 333-6280.
Coming up on tomorrow's Focus, in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with award-winning journalist Bryce Hoffman, author of American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. At the end of 2008, Ford was running on empty. In an effort to save the American auto industry, Congress offered a bailout. GM and Chrysler took the money, but Ford decided to save itself. The company did so by hiring an outsider, Alan Mulally, and it turned out to be a very good hire. By early 2010, it was clear Ford had pulled off one of the most amazing turnarounds in history. We'll get the story from Bryce Hoffman. That's tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour of the program. Then at 11 o'clock, a conversation with Gerald Danzer, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Illinois, Chicago, about his book, Illinois, A History in Pictures. That's on Focus tomorrow. It's 11:59. The Afternoon Magazine is coming up next here on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen, and among the stories we're following at this hour, Illinois labor leaders are speaking out about Governor Pat Quinn as Democrats gather for Governor's Day at the State Fair. We'll tell you about that. A couple of airports in central Illinois are using federal money to try to add service to the nation's capital, and this is the first day young immigrants can apply for a new program that allows them to stay and work in the country. Details ahead on all of those. Also, we'll tell you about zip line safety in the state of Illinois in the next hour. Let's update you on what's happening in the commodity market, starting with Kansas City wheat for September at 856 and three quarters, up 4 3/4. December wheat at 881 and three quarters, up 5. Chicago wheat for September is at 844 and a half, up 4 3/4. December wheat at 863 and a half, up 5 1/4. September corn's at 788 and a quarter, up 8 1/2. December corn at 797 and a half, up 8 1/2. March 2013 corn at 799 and three quarters,